to be looked at and gone into in greater depth. My name's Paul. This is Cable Community Radio, Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned.
Monica Beamer.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. We are KBOO's new co-station managers. We're excited to be a part of the KBOO community. We're starting a new weekly feature on Wednesdays at 5:45 p.m. News from the Boo will give you an inside look into what's happening at KBOO, including upcoming events, station news, special programming, and future goals and plans for the station.
Be sure to tune in this Wednesday and every Wednesday after the KBOO Evening News for News from the Boo, an insider look into your community radio station.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscasts. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
I'm Monica Beamer.
Whoa, we already heard that one. Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning. Coming right up, it's political perspectives on the program. Today, we hear about... We hear Mind Talk with host Dr. Pamela Brewer. Today's guest is Dr. Alice Boys. They'll talk about anxiety and how to deal with it. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with host Chris Andre. At 10:15, stay tuned for flashpoints on today's show. We hear a number of topics, including Obama's drone program in Yemen will be discussed. We'll talk about privatization of America. At 11 o'clock to noon, it's the Recovery Zone. On today's show, solar consultant Jesse Hunter joins host Stephanie Potter for a discussion about climate change and renewable energy. Stay tuned for all that. Coming right up, it's Political Perspectives. Thanks for tuning into KBOO this morning, and I hope you enjoy the programming.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's conversation is about anxiety. And for those of us who are breathing and walking around on the planet, I think we all have had some experience, some exposure to that experience of anxiety. So we're going to take a mini break. And when we come back, you'll meet today's guest. So you relax, get comfortable. We'll be back. I am happy to introduce today's guest to you. Her name is Dr. Alice Boys, and Dr. Boys' expertise in social, clinical, positive, and relationship psychology topics has actually been featured in magazines and radio segments, and certainly in a recent publication that she has created entitled The Anxiety Toolkit. And again, as you heard me say a few moments ago, I think we all have had at some point in our lives some introduction
stuck
and you can't do anything and you just feel like you're stuck. Let's start with what a description of anxiety is. When you think about anxiety, as you were writing this book, what was your definition of anxiety?
Yeah, so anxiety has different components. It has the emotions component, so feeling nervous, worried, anxious, any of those synonyms. Then it has a cognitive component, so having thoughts, you know, run over and over in your mind, or anticipatory anxiety about something that you might have coming up. And then it also has a behavioral component, which is includes things like avoidance coping is a very big one. So procrastinating about things, or maybe avoiding having potentially awkward conversations. And then it also, of course, has a physical component, like your heart racing, and those types of things that happen for people when they're anxious. So it's sort of a syndrome that has that. There's four prongs: the physical, behavioral, cognitive, and emotional.
Now, one of the things that I know about your background, Dr. Boyce, is that you are originally from New Zealand.
Yes.
And now you're living in Las Vegas. That seems
yes.
to me to be a fairly big switch. Did you experience any anxiety going from New Zealand to Las Vegas, Nevada?
I'm not particularly, mostly excitement. It's been a really exciting thing for me to move to the US. And I'd traveled a lot to the US before. So I had lots of experience driving on the other side of the road. So we drive on the left in New Zealand. And I remember the first few times that I drove on the right-hand side of the road in the States, that was pretty anxiety provoking. But by the time we actually moved over here, pretty much that those processes had been worked through.
So you kind of had a down pat by the time you got here.
Yeah, I'd been traveling here like every year for 10 years or so before
okay.
we moved. So, yeah, and I love Americans. So.
Well, you know, I think about travel, and certainly there are many people for whom travel, particularly perhaps driving over bridges or those kinds of things, or air travel, is really an anxiety-provoking experience for them. So for those kinds of folks, what are some of the things that you think happen that keep them so stuck in that fear of what could happen?
Yeah, so a lot of it is, for people with anxiety problems, they a really common thing, for example, is anxiety about getting stuck in a middle seat. So there's often a lot of anticipatory anxiety.
Mm.
And, of course, like an air travel experience especially is something that you can't control. And you also get exposed to all those kind of fear-inducing cues when you're going through an airport. So, when you're having all the screening and checking and things that's been done, that's really like putting in the forefront of your mind all the risks associated with terrorism. And, the safety briefing, of course, it's designed to help you feel more safe, but it also reminds you of the risks and things that could go wrong.
Sure.
So, it probably really is just looking at those old people often say that stat about how you're much safer traveling in a flight rather than in your daily commute in your car. So that can help people, but also just being as prepared as possible and allowing time so that it's not a rushed experience, so that you can kind of you can use strategies to reduce your anxiety, slow breathing, and all of those basic strategies. And if you need an aisle seat, then it might be paying the little bit extra to get to choose your seat, or those kinds of things.
I wonder, you talk in your book about the fact that you kind of have an anxious nature, although not an anxiety disorder as such. And I wonder, in today's world where literally every moment that one looks at a piece of news, however they collect their news, something horrific is being reported. Do you think that in general we are a more anxious people, or no?
I think that anxiety maybe has changed a little bit. Like, there are new sources of anxiety. Social media would be one of them that comes up for people a lot. They're sort of just different forms of the same basic anxiety. Like, social anxiety often gets triggered for people via social media or via via email conversation. So email is especially anxiety triggering for people that are prone to rumination, so people that are prone to sort of overthinking things. So often people will get an email that's maybe a bit abruptly worded, or maybe the person's tone in the email isn't as positive as what it would usually be, and the person thinks that maybe something's wrong. So people can end up kind of replaying emails or overthinking about what they're going to write in an email, those kinds of things.
So it's interesting that you say that emails can be something that can actually increase anxiety, because I think that a lot of people don't think about emails in that way. But as you talk about it, it makes perfect sense. You used a word rumination. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah. So we usually term worry to be overthinking about things that haven't happened but that you're worried might happen in the future, whereas rumination tends to be overthinking about things that already have happened. So, you've had an awkward conversation with somebody and you're replaying over and over and over in your mind how it might have gone differently, or what you said, what the other person said, and thinking about maybe what the reasons could have been for it, or doing a lot of self-criticism. So that's generally, we see that we think about rumination as being thoughts about things that have happened, and worry as being thoughts about things that might happen.
That might happen. Okay. What you say several things in your book, which is very much a workbook, which I thought was really helpful, particularly with something like anxiety. One of the comments that you make is the fact that trying to eliminate anxiety can cause anxiety, but you also say that you need to acknowledge when your anxiety is getting in the way. And I can see, I understand that those are two separate thoughts, but I can see folks who struggle with anxiety really kind of putting those together and feeling, what is often the case for folks with anxiety, stuck. How do I acknowledge it? How do I acknowledge that it's getting in the way, but then not acknowledge, then not pay attention to it? How do I get rid of it? It becomes such an exhausting cycle for folks who are anxious.
Yeah, it's a lot like sleep. So, we get all these messages about how it's important to get enough sleep. And then as soon as, for people that have sleep problems, being told all of the harm caused by not getting enough sleep just causes them to have so many thoughts about not being able to sleep.
That they can't get to sleep, right?
Yeah. So it can be a lot, and we know that's that you get into those sort of catch-22 situations, and it is a really delicate balance between allowing yourself to feel your feelings but not allowing yourself to brood and ruminate and do the kinds of things that we know intensify anxiety. So anxiety and all, there's a big movement in psychology at the moment to acknowledge that things that are have traditionally been called, quote-unquote negative emotions, they actually can be really helpful, and they all have an evolutionary purpose. So we've evolved every emotion in our repertoire, including anxiety, guilt, shame, sadness, because it has some sort of useful purpose. So it's about sort of acknowledging that, but not doing the kinds of things that people do that stop anxiety being a temporary emotion. So it's designed as a signaling system that signals us that we're entering a situation that's unknown or a bit out of control, or where there might be a danger present. And because sort of all of our alert systems are designed to be over cautious, so they alert us to false alarms because the danger of missing a real situation is so great. So we get these sort of false alarms that are built into the system just to be extra cautious. But what people can do is get into patterns. One of them, for example, is self-criticism, where people really beat themselves up. And, those behaviours that people do are what cause anxiety to intensify and to last a lot longer than it would without that extra added fuel. without that extra gas to the fire.
So for someone who, for example, is anxious about being anxious, and I think a lot of folks who are anxious about being anxious, and blaming and shaming and all of those things. When you talk about the need to acknowledge that you do have anxiety and that it is getting in the way, how would someone like that acknowledge it without, you know, all of the negative, exhausting judgments that come along with that? If I say to myself, I'm really anxious, how do I stop myself from saying, and that makes me a bad person, and I'm this, and I'm that, and I'm the other?
Yeah, so kind of by recognizing that, you know, that as a sort of tribe of people, it's good that to have diversity in that tribe. So it's good to have people who are really bold and people who are really cautious, and then most people be in the middle. But it's good to have some people at the, you know, at either extreme. It's good to have some people who are really, really optimistic. And it's good to have some people that are looking out for things that could go wrong. So having that diversity is actually like a really good thing. So that's one of the ways that people can maybe feel a little bit better about their nature. But I guess the big thing is that when anxiety isn't causing problems for you in your life, and when it's not really distressing for you, it's a lot easier to accept it as part of your nature. So once you have like your toolkit of strategies in place that you use for sort of titrating your anxiety, for keeping it at an okay level, it's a lot easier to accept that you've got a fundamentally anxious nature. And that's where I've got to personally. Like I still fall into the thinking traps that I've always fallen into, but now I automatically recognize them as thinking traps. Like I say that that it's a lot like having like a built-in spell checker, where I notice myself making the thinking errors and then can kind of automatically correct them. And people can, you know, other people can get to that stage too.
Dr. Boyes, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to pick up with another word that you use. I'm not sure folks really understand what that means. So folks, we'll be right back, and we will continue our conversation with Dr. Alice Boyes, the author of The Anxiety Toolkit, Strategies for Fine-Tuning Your Mind and Moving Past Your Stuck Points. Boys, one of the things that you just said, essentially, I think, was that some people can be particularly bold, some people can be particularly cautious, and some people can kind of fall out in the middle, and that none of that is good or bad. It is simply speaks to the diversity of us as human beings.
Yeah, it's exactly that. Like, it's sort of like in between, you know, extroversion and introversion. It's not better or worse to be an extrovert or an introvert. It's just the natural diversity that we have as humans.
Gotcha. You also said titrating the anxiety. What does that mean?
Yeah, so just kind of keeping it at an okay level. So there's a certain amount of anxiety can actually help, can prompt you to be prepared for things, or to be aware of how you're being perceived and what you need to do to put your best foot forward, those kinds of things. But then knowing the point where it doesn't become useful anymore. So perfectionism is also kind of similar, like perfectionism and having high standards.
Mm.
Work, it can be like a really healthy strategy sometimes, but you've got to also be aware of when it's working and when it's not working, sort of when it's overdoing it, and when something's at a good level. So, you know, for example, let's say that you're going on a big international trip, you're going to Thailand and you're maybe traveling on your own, or you've never done that sort of international travel before. You know, you think about all the things that you wanted to do to make sure that you had a safe trip.
Sure.
And, you know, there are reasonable things to do that actually, you know, your anxiety about safety and things is prompting you to take those reasonable actions. And then there's a level where it gets unreasonable.
Right.
So kind of, you know, figuring that out for yourself and putting some boundaries around the, you know, not keeping on doing things beyond the level where it's useful.
So when you talk about titrating the anxiety, it sounds like you're saying bringing it down essentially to a mild roar. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, like so using things like mindfulness meditation, for example, to get your physiological arousal down to an okay level.
Okay.
So, you know, having anxiety about performance, you know, having a certain level of anxiety about a performance can be quite useful. And part of the reason is that anxiety and excitement are so kind of closely related physiologically. They feel very similar.
Mm.
So one of the things that you can do is just label your emotions as, you know, as excitement. But you also, you know, beyond a certain level, that's where you want to be doing some slow breathing or, you know, those kinds of basic strategies that that keep it at a useful, in that kind of useful range.
You know, you just said that anxiety and excitement kind of have the same effect on the body. And I think that's an important piece for folks to really think about, because so often, if you're in that particularly anxious space, you don't think about anything except the thing that you're most afraid of in that moment. So to recognize that there is a physical component, I mean, how many people go to the emergency room because they think they're having a heart attack and it's not a heart attack at all? You know, it's really someone who's dealing with an anxiety attack, if you will, which doesn't mean you shouldn't go to the hospital because you never know. But it's just so important to be able to give ourselves added language to how we think about the experience of anxiety, which I think happens in your book, throughout the book, which I think is really useful, and I appreciated that approach. You talked a moment ago about perfectionism, and you've got a chapter in your book entitled Paralyzing Perfectionism. Now, for those who really kind of celebrate perfectionism, they think often that that is the only goal to aspire to. And in fact, if that's your only measure of being okay, you're kind of setting yourself up for failure and feeling imperfect and feeling anxious and all of those things. How do you shift one? How does one shift their sense of perfectionism?
Yeah, so one of the big problems with perfectionism is when people are putting all their eggs in one basket. So, you know, when someone's self-esteem is really linked to just one domain of their life. So, you know, it might be somebody who is like a gymnast or something, the Olympics, or you know, where it's people just place all of their self-esteem comes from being a good parent. And then if their child is having some difficulty, they really, you know, they take that extremely personally, or where people judge themselves on, you know, their sales numbers or, you know, whatever it is.
Sure.
The problem is generally for people that have got, where their self-esteem really hinges on just one domain of their life, or maybe just one or two domains, rather than being broader and, you know, being about the fact that they, you know, that they recycle, or that they're someone that, that, you know, has creative pursuits or other hobbies, and that, you know, has that sort of a more sources of self-esteem than just one or two.
You know, there's so much attention paid, I think, in the world today about productivity, that it's just so easy to connect your self-esteem to how productive you are, connect how productive you are to how perfect you are. And I think certainly about people who are in jobs that, you know, are sales jobs or somehow result in some sort of measurable thing. And I don't know what kind of job doesn't. And so when you think about perfectionism as you're saying, if you think about perfectionism as I've created 10 of these measures and I was supposed to create 11, so I'm a failure, that it actually gets in the way of your productivity rather than enhancing your productivity. And one of the things that I note in your chapter, on all of your chapters, but certainly in the chapter on perfectionism, is you actually ask people lots of different questions to rate themselves. And they're just three ratings, A, B, or C, never, sometimes, or often. And so, well, in some of them, but they're just three ratings, so that it makes it easy for the person to rate themselves on how well or how much in trouble they really are with their own way of thinking about perfectionism and perhaps being paralyzed by it.
Yeah, and the critical thing with perfectionism is that, you know, it, of course, that perfectionism can be a healthy strategy. It can be the thing that helps you rise to the top in a competitive profession. But the problem kind of perfectionism is either when doing that causes you to feel like you're not having a life. Mm. Now, there are some people out there who throw themselves into their work and can maintain relationships, and other people might look from the outside and say they don't seem to be having much of a life outside work. But for that person, it works for them particularly, you know, it works for them fine. So it really is an individual thing. But for a lot of people who are what we call clinical perfectionists, their perfectionism actually gets in the way of their performance. It actually makes their performance worse. So, you know, someone that was a perfectionist that might be thinking that they might want to move houses, they might think to themselves, well, I know I'm not going to find a house that ticks every single box for me, so I'm just not going to look. Or I'm not going to ever delegate anything to anyone else because I don't trust that anyone will do it to my standards. Or arriving super, super early for every single appointment because you're worried about being late. So there are things that you know, if you're a problem perfectionist, if you're doing the kinds of things that are actually making your performance worse rather than better.
It sounds like it actually can interfere with the quality of your life.
Yeah. So, often interferes with relationships. That's, when people, I'm not a therapist anymore, but when I was, the reason that people would end up coming in to see someone after having had their problems for a really long time was often because their partner or spouse had got to the point where they just couldn't take it anymore. They were like, you need to go and get some help for these issues because it's interfering with our relationship. So if someone doesn't feel confident that they can do something perfectly, like they need to make a phone call to customer service to sort something out, and they don't feel confident they're going to get it just right enough, they might sort of try and make their spouse do it. And those kinds of things can really, they're so perfectionistic, they don't let their spouse do anything around the house because their spouse doesn't wash the dishes just exactly the way that they like them to be washed, or those kinds of things. So that's often what, that's one of the big problems with perfectionism, is how it affects your relationships.
You also say that one should switch from a performance focus to a mastery focus. Describe that shift.
Yeah, so a performance focus is when you're thinking about that you need to do really well each time you do something. You want to show others that you're really good at something that you want. Whereas a mastery focus is when you can tolerate maybe not being perfect now because you're on your way to being to mastery at that skill. So, you know, somebody that is trying to master the skill of public speaking will put themselves out there and take opportunities to do public speaking, and thinking that that the more and more experience they get, the better and better they're going to get at it. So they're trying to achieve mastery rather than they're trying to achieve a perfect performance right then.
And, you know, I think the interesting thing is the more that you focus on achieving mastery, the more you are actually able to perfect your performance. Not that it's 1,000% perfect, but the more you are able to do that. So it's almost, I think what you're saying is the more you're able to sort of calm yourself, the better you can be at whatever it is you do.
Yeah, like, you know, somebody that's got a mastery goal is going to be more willing to accept feedback, whereas someone that's got a performance goal where they're just desperate to perform well each and every time, they need to hit it out of the park each time they come up to bat. They are going to be really intolerant of any feedback. They're going to really sort of close themselves off to that because it's so excruciatingly painful for them. Whereas someone that has got a mastery focus knows that that's part of the path toward their, you know, their bigger goal.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about some of the things that happens with parents and students that can actually grow anxiety for students who are trying to move forward. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and we're having a conversation with Dr. Alice Boyes, who is the author of The Anxiety Toolkit, Strategies for Fine-Tuning Your Mind and Moving Past Your Stuck Points. She's got a great website with lots of information. We'll get to that as well as soon as we come back. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer, and we're continuing the conversation with Dr. Alice Boyes. Dr. Boyes, you know, schools, everything is so competitive these days, as you know. I mean, I hear parents talking about putting their children on waiting lists for nursery school. I mean, it's just gotten kind of crazy in a lot of ways. So for the parents who want their child to get the scholarship, go to the good schools, whatever good schools, quote unquote, means to that parent, very often they get caught up in a battle, I think, with their children about doing A or A plus work. Mm-hmm. And I think what happens, and please, I'd like your take on this, but I think what happens is that both the parent and the child wind up becoming more and more anxious about the production of an A versus really being able to learn and grow and thrive, and for the child actually being able to be a child, for the parent actually being able to enjoy being a parent. What's your thought?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things is that, I mean, that's one of the, I mean, as I said earlier, I absolutely love Americans and love America, but it's, you know, that sort of approach to parenting, it's quite shocking to someone who's not American, because it's not the approach to parenting that is taken in my home country of New Zealand or places like Australia, or it's, you know, in so many other ways, we're such similar cultures.
Uh-huh.
But it really is this you know, the amount of homework given to students in America is just absolutely crippling.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of, I guess, recognizing that there are other ways that, you know, that people are all caught up in this America of the culture is very caught up in this intense competitiveness about schooling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, recognizing that maybe that you need to sort of step out of that. So in the same way that people sort of recognize they need to step out of that sort of consumerist culture where they don't need to keep up with the Joneses,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of the size of house or size of SUV they have, that they, you know, that they might need to sort of step back from the culture a little bit and kind of consciously opt out of that process. But also just recognizing that there's so many different routes to success. Like, it's not that, you know, it's not that your child's life will be over if they don't get into Harvard. You know,
right.
maybe thinking of some actual, you know, lots of different examples of different kinds of success that people achieve and the different pathways that people go through, and really kind of teaching your children about those examples of the different ways that people can be happy and the different ways that people can be successful.
So are you saying that one of the main differences between the parenting style of your homeland and America is the competitiveness that parents kind of impose on themselves and their children?
Yeah. And it's,
okay.
You know, that's, as I said, like, so much is just exactly the same between America and sort of New Zealand and Australia.
Uh-huh.
But this is something that's quite a stark, you know, a stark difference. And, you know, I guess I feel a little bit sorry for, you know, kids and parents that are putting themselves under that kind of pressure. So it's sort of, it's, you know, the key is acknowledging that you feel that kind of pressure, that, you know, you feel that sort of that social pressure.
Mm-hmm.
But taking a step back from it.
Let me ask you this. Your book, would you say that it would be useful for kids in high school on up, or do you see it as solidly for adults, 18 and over?
Yeah, sort of solidly for adults mainly. So kids have a more limited ability to reflect on their own thinking.
Okay.
So it is mainly aimed at adults, but definitely college students would be, so sort of 17, 18-year-olds maybe. And it's also aimed, you know, particularly at people who have everyday anxiety. So
okay.
There's a, you know, we know a lot about treating anxiety disorders, but there hasn't been much translation of those techniques into kind of lower key versions that can be used by people who don't have anxiety disorders,
but that are
still effective. So, you know, it is aimed at, you know, mostly at people who have an anxious nature or find themselves having anxiety spikes at various times in their life, like with their work or, you know, in their personal lives, and who need some simple strategies to use that aren't too overwhelming.
Okay. Okay. You talk about recognizing the value of acting with uncertainty, which for somebody mm-hmm. who's really anxious, it has got to sound like the nuttiest thing in the world to say. You know, uncertainty for them is what creates the anxiety. So that you would say there is value in acting with the uncertainty. How do you want folks to think about that concept?
Yeah, so one of the big mechanisms that we know that's really important in anxiety disorders is that people with anxiety disorders delay taking action until they feel 100% certain of success.
Mm.
And what they tend to do is they, you know, might engage in lots of researching a topic, you know, lots of internet searching or that type of thing before they, to try and reach those feelings of 100% certainty.
Mm-hmm.
And the more, the, you know, the longer that goes on for, the harder it is to take action, and usually the less certain that they end up feeling.
Right.
So it's about recognizing that you know, that a lot of what we all achieve in life is through actions where we didn't feel certain. And for people that have got an anxiety-prone nature, they'll often feel a bit uncertain about big decisions. So, you know, things like buying a house or, you know, moving somewhere to take another job or those kinds of things. But their nature is to feel uneasy about new things. And sometimes that uneasiness is often that uneasiness is a false alarm.
Okay. So sometimes, lots of folks are really good at saying, you know, just kind of go with your gut. Just pay attention to what you're thinking. But my sense is that the caveat is you have to make sure that gut of yours doesn't tend to be anxious. Because if it does, then you're really going to start engaging in behaviors that will actually grow the anxiety versus reduce the anxiety.
Yeah, so some people's gut is just, like, and, you know, me included, is that when there's ever any sort of change of plans or something new is proposed to me, I sort of want to say no and put my walls up, because I always think about the things that could go wrong. Or I think about how if I agree to do this thing, then I'm going to spend the next 2 weeks feeling anxious about the fact I agreed to do that thing, or it's going to make me feel more overwhelmed, or all of those things. So, like, I know that my gut instinct is usually to say no to things, mm-hmm. But there's, you know, there's often like a little smaller gut instinct in there, a quieter gut instinct that wants to explore a new opportunity, or and it's about kind of understanding maybe that quieter instinct as well.
So are you saying that for those folks for whom the first line of reaction is to say no, that there's some anxiety underneath for those folks?
Yeah, there often is.
Okay.
Yeah, and as I said, it's sometimes about the idea that, you know, if you agree to something that you think will be anxiety provoking, that it's going to be unpleasant for you, and, you know, from the point that you agree to it until the actual event, because you're going to be anticipating what could happen.
For the person who is particularly prone to anxiety, which is often, you know, tagged along with negative self-talk, for that person who gets feedback, and almost unless the feedback is glorious, they burst into tears. Is that someone who's just sort of sensitive, or is that someone who might be struggling with anxiety?
Yeah, that's probably someone who's struggling with anxiety, and probably someone that fits into that clinical perfectionism model as well. So, and that is a really, you know, a really common issue. And even, you know, even when we, you know, brought up the issue of email before, like, sometimes people are so used to somebody writing back to them and saying, great job, when they, you know, in response to their work, that if someone writes back and says, the same person writes back and says, good job, they think, oh, what's wrong? You know, what weren't they happy with? And, you know, that's a real vicious cycle, because, the more you try and avoid negative feedback at all costs, the more nervous you get about it. So when you do get a little bit of negative feedback and you realize you can cope with it, then it starts to get less scary.
You know, I'm along the lines of getting negative feedback. If you're working in an environment where you have colleagues or certainly a supervisor who him or herself tends to be really anxious and negative, is there a way to kind of insulate yourself from that person, or how should you think about that person who's your supervisor, who has a direct impact on your employment?
Yeah. I mean, there sometimes are no really easy answers to that, but some of it is recognizing other people's stuff as their own stuff. You know, that if you've got a supervisor who one of the things is if you're not, for example, a clinical perfectionist, sometimes understanding about clinical perfectionism is something that really helps you understand other people. Like you start to understand why your boss gets super, has super high standards about typos or things that don't really matter, and just kind of trying to recognize that as their own stuff rather than something that's really about you.
So again, it's a matter of shifting how you're thinking about how you're thinking. And you do, I know that cognitive behavioral therapy is something that you value a great deal. Can you talk for a moment about just what that approach is?
Yeah, so there have been lots and lots of studies of cognitive behavioral therapy. It was one of the first types of psychotherapy to really be put under the microscope of research, and it's been around since the 1960s, so there's a lot of evidence for it, and it's generally considered to be the type of therapy that has the best evidence for it in terms of anxiety problems. And so cognitive just means thinking and behavioral just means behaviors. So it's the name is saying that it aims to affect your emotions by working on both behaviors and thoughts. And the behavioral component is really important. So we know that, especially for anxiety, that it's behavioral changes that often make the most, the biggest impact on both thoughts and feelings. So people learning to approach things that they would usually avoid is the thing that causes the breakthroughs for people. So they call it exposure therapy, where you sort of gradually expose yourself to the things that you're afraid of. And for something like worry, it might be actually, for example, there's a technique where you vividly imagine a really embarrassing situation, like whatever your fear is about the worst kind of embarrassing situation that you could experience, you vividly imagine that, and you do that till you sort of get your peak level of anxiety. And then you might say, well, my peak level of anxiety that I feel when I do that vivid imagining is like an 8 out of 10 or a 9 out of 10. Mm-hmm. And then what you do is you keep the image in your mind, so you keep imagining until your anxiety falls to about half, so until it falls to about a 4 or a 5. And then you repeat that same process until you can bring up that imagery without such a huge initial spike. So you might get to the point where you can bring it up and it only causes a 4 out of 5 of sort of that physical anxiety response. So those kinds of what we call exposure techniques, we basically know from the research studies, are the most effective ways of dealing with anxiety problems.
Okay. Folks, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I promise you I'm going to ask Dr. Boyes to give us her website because there's lots of information on her website. And I'd like to just take a quick look through some of the anxiety reduction strategies, Dr. Boyes, that you've listed on your site. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be right back, I promise. Dr. Alice Boyes, who is the author of the Anxiety Toolkit, has created a list of 50 ways to reduce anxiety. Dr. Boyes, how does someone access that list?
Yeah, so that's on my blog for Psychology Today. So if people Google my name plus Psychology Today, or Google my name plus 50 ways to reduce anxiety, they'll find it. I have been writing a blog for Psychology Today since 2012. So that's where my most recent articles are, and there are over 100 articles there.
And the way to spell your name is Alicebowyes.
Yep.
Okay. Now, I'm looking at your list of 50 ways to reduce anxiety. Who knew there were 50 ways? And some
there is way more than 50 ways. That was just where I stopped.
and you know, that's the hopeful piece, because first of all, people don't think that they're, for somebody who's anxious and in the moment, the last thing they think about is that there's something that they can do as an individual to reduce it. So to think that there are 50 ways, and yes, there are even more than 50 ways, it's really kind of a gift in and of itself. Some of the things that are on your list, you know, I was reading them, I said, yeah. And then, you know, some of them I got to and I thought, okay, now that's interesting. So, you know, taking deep breaths, you know, giving yourself a massage, taking a day trip. Okay. And then you say, throw something out of your fridge. How does that reduce my anxiety?
Yeah. So we've got a sort of a natural wiring that sort of having things in order and having some control helps us feel calmer. So that, you know, these are really simple things that people can do. And a big problem with anxiety is that it causes negative expectations. So people read through a list and they think, oh, no, that won't help. Oh, no, that won't help. Oh, no, that won't help.
Uh-huh.
And they don't actually try those things to see if it will help. And also people have those perfectionist expectations where they think, I want something that's going to completely take away my anxiety. I'm not interested in something that might just help a little bit, even if it's like a super simple 30-second thing that they could do. So those are the things that get in people's way of trying those really simple strategies. And they, you know, sometimes sound a bit boring, but they, you know, they actually work. And you know, it might be that not everything works for everybody, but a lot of the problem with people is people actually not being willing to try things. Is people having that having that negative expectation, which is a symptom of anxiety, right? So
right.
It's why we talk about stuck points and anxiety traps. Is that it's the symptoms of anxiety and it's the effect that anxiety has on your thinking that stops you doing the really simple things that would actually help you.
So, in fact, rather than allowing yourself to really get caught up and burdened with the negative thoughts that you have, you're saying that things as simple as taking a bath, making a phone call, throwing something away, bringing physical order to your life can begin to reduce some of that anxiety.
Yeah, and these are not meant as treatments for anxiety disorders.
Sure, absolutely.
Like, there are very good treatments for anxiety disorders.
Right.
These are meant for when you're, you know, maybe finding yourself ruminating about something and you need to kind of break that cycle, or when you have something that you can't control in your life, and you want to, and you need to kind of just get yourself, you know, you need to get yourself situated, you need to get back to a bit of an even keel. And some of these wee things that you can do can give you enough of a boost that you start to feel like you could take even bigger steps. So maybe you've got a really, you know, an anxiety-provoking phone call that you're putting off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, doing a couple of wee jobs around your house, you know, doing a couple of other things maybe that you've been putting off, like throwing out the yogurt in your fridge that went off 2 months ago. Doing those really simple initial things is what can then give you a boost that enables you to feel like you can accomplish those things, those other bigger things that you might have been putting off.
Talk about the value, literally, of giving yourself a hand massage. You said that will activate oxytocin. How does that happen?
Yeah, so, you know, we're So oxytocin is the bonding hormone. So it's designed to make us feel safe and secure. So you can rub your arm. You can lightly put your fingers across your lips. You can kiss someone or hug someone. So it's just a natural way of getting a safer and secure feeling, if that's what you're seeking.
There are so many wonderful ways to reduce anxiety. Another of the things that you suggested that you accept that there is a gap between your real self and your ideal self, and you add, which is pretty much the case for everybody, that there is a gap between your real self and your ideal self. And the inference being that that's not only human, but it's okay.
Yeah. There are days when I, think, oh, that was, I'm being really self-centered today, or I'm being really selfish today. And I think, oh, I don't, that's such a negative connotation. I don't want to be that person. But if you can recognize that gap, it can actually sort of recognize and accepting can help reduce those perfectionism monsters, so that you end up actually behaving in a much more useful way, where you think, okay, well, I'll do something small that's not self-centered and selfish, and reduce that gap, even if I don't feel like I can completely reduce that gap to zero.
Another suggestion that you offer is to do a task 25% more slowly. I could see somebody who's really anxious getting caught up in whether or not they're actually reducing it a full 25%, mm-hmm. or maybe it's,
yeah.
How do you want somebody to think about that recommendation?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. So all of these, and a big, huge point that I make in the book, is that you never have to do a task, use a strategy exactly as it's described.
Okay.
So what we want is for people to make the strategies their own, to find a way of doing things that that works for them, and find shortcuts and things. So the techniques that we use in therapy are often quite structured and quite full-on for people. They're quite intense, but when you move into like more of an everyday life situation where you're not working on a problem intensively in a therapy relationship, you want to have like shortcut versions of all these strategies. So to do that, you have to find your own way of doing them, where it doesn't feel like a chore. So things like meditation, it's often recommended to do like a 45-minute meditation. And that might be what we have people doing if they're in therapy. But in real life, you might end up doing a 3-minute meditation,
okay.
On more of an ongoing basis. And you might not do it every day. You might just do it when you feel like you need it, or you might just do it a couple times a week, or whatever it is. So all of these things are put out there as a template that you can use, and then you can take that template and try out a way that works for you. And you really have to self-experiment and find what works for you. And then you have to, switch things up if you find that a strategy that was working isn't working so well anymore.
You can change it to something that does work. Dr. Alice Boyes, who is author of the Anxiety Toolkit, Dr. Alice Boyes, who is author of the Anxiety Toolkit, Strategies for Fine-Tuning Your Mind and Moving Past Your Stuck Points. Thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. And remember, folks, Alice Boyes. You can do a Google search and you can find more information about the book and the 50 ways to reduce anxiety, along with lots of other information that Dr. Boyes has available for you online. Dr. Boyes, thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
folks, I want to thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. And remember, you can always listen to Mind Talk on demand at myndtalk.org. The managing producer is Jim Brown in 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service and is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. And remember, for more information about Mind Talk, you can go to mindtalk.org. Again, that is myndtalk.org. And folks, remember, always remember, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable.
It's 9:59. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned to KBOO at 10:15 for Flashpoints. At 11 o'clock, it's the Recovery Zone with Stephanie Potter. Today's show is all about climate change and renewable energy. But right now, it's time for Air Cascadia with big news from Greenpeace. Chris is going to have the guest. It will be from Greenpeace, so stay tuned for that right after this important message.
Every day, local businesses support KBOO through program sponsorship or underwriting. These underwriters are people like you, progressive, diverse, and supporting real radio. So when you hear an underwriter's acknowledgement, consider giving them some of your business and telling them that you heard about them on KBOO. If your business would like to reach out to the area's 55,000 most diverse and progressive listeners, you can learn how at kboo.fm/underwriting. By email to underwriting@kboo.org, or call Justin 503-231-8032. KBOO Underwriting. Your clients are listening.